This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The greatest United States senator of our time is the way President Obama remembered Ted Kennedy today. Kennedy's death last night at the age of 77 from brain cancer marks the end of an era, the end of his generation of Kennedy political leaders. Ted Kennedy represented Massachusetts in the Senate for more than 46 years. He was elected to his brother John Kennedy's seat in 1962 when he was barely old enough to hold the office. He was a staunch advocate of liberal causes and described health care reform as the cause of his life. He was also an outspoken critic of the war in Iraq, saying that the best vote he ever cast in the Senate was against going to war. We're going to listen back to the interview Senator Kennedy recorded with Fresh Air contributor Dave Davies in 2006, after the publication of Kennedy's book outlining his policy priorities called America Back on Track.
Senator Kennedy, welcome to Fresh Air. Your book deals with a whole lot of areas, from health care to tax policy to labor relations. And I think, you know, if your book were the platform of a political candidate, and your opponent would probably go through here and add up the cost of all of the additional initiatives, and there are many, increasing unemployment compensation, increasing spending on early childhood education, college funding, federal job training. Someone would look at this and say this is an unrealistic, classic liberal tax and spend, throw money at the problem approach to government. Can America afford it?
Well, let's take some of these issues. When we put into place the Cold War GI Bill to pay for the education of all the veterans that returned from World War II, the Treasury's analysis of that showed that the Treasury received $7 for every dollar it invested in education, because these individuals had a considerable success in terms of their life career. Sil Conti, who was a Republican congressman from Massachusetts, and Tip O'Neill were the great advocates of that program. And, of course, it paid for itself many, many, many times over. Take, for example, health care. For every dollar that we are spending in health care now, 33 cents of that is non-clinical. That's administrative costs that are paying it now. No business could survive that. We are supporting the information technology. Information technology, the IT, bringing electronics into the paying of bills and the administrative costs. The Institutes of Medicine, the Academy of Sciences, said if you brought in information technology into the current healthcare system, you'd save between $150 and $175 billion a year. Do you hear me? $150 to $175 billion a year, more than enough to afford to have a national health insurance policy. Secondly, we do very poorly in the area of preventive healthcare. One out of every $4 that we spend in Medicare is on diabetes. One out of every $10 we spend on health care is on diabetes. There is a great deal that can be done in terms of the prevention in terms of diabetes that we don't do that can save billions and billions of dollars. You know, the fact is, if we do this in the right way, if we take into consideration prevention, if we bring into the right technologies, if we deal with the health care in the comprehensive way, we can bring the health care, if we have more competition in terms of the prescription drugs, we can bring the health care costs down, and we can pass a program. We are spending everything that needs to be spent in health care. It's just being spent in the wrong way.
Few people have had the same job for 43 years. You won election to the United States Senate in 1962. Not long after Lyndon Johnson was majority leader. I mean, you have a long tenure in this body. How has it changed?
Well, it's the most dramatic shift and change has been the force of and the presence of money and the need and necessity for candidates to go out and raise a lot of money and therefore draw them away from doing what they should be doing, and that is attending to the United States Senate. When I first arrived there, that was a 12-month job. We got used to get the 4th of July and Labor Day, And we got Christmas. I was in the mid 1960s. We were in between Christmas and New Year's voting. At that time, it was voting on the war in Vietnam. We used to get back, leave late Friday afternoon, and get back Sunday nights and be ready to go. Now, candidates and the Senate, for all intents and purposes, doesn't get going till Tuesday noon, and most of the senators are gone Thursday night. Back to raise resources for their campaigns, and it's we are I think a lesser institution, and failing to really deal with the what we should be dealing with, and that's the people's business. I think there's a way of dealing with it. I'm a strong believer in public financing of campaigns. In 1973, I had legislation with Hugh Scott, who was the Republican leader. To provide public financing of House and Senate and presidential campaigns. And we actually won it in the Senate, but we couldn't get the House of Representatives to go along with it. They've done some in the presidential campaigns, but it's in disfavor today. But that seems to me to be the way that we eventually have to go, because we are failing in our responsibilities, I think, to the American people institutionally.
Well, I guess we should briefly address this issue of campaign finance reform, because, you know, there was the reforms of the 70s and then more recently the McCain-Feingold measure, which, you know, it seems has really failed to keep big, soft money out of elections. Why is that, and where do we go from here?
Well, as I say, I'm... I believe that what is necessary, what is called for, is the public financing of elections. You know, the best estimate now is that the lobbyists spend about $10 billion a year to influence legislation, about $10 billion a year. That is vastly more than what would be necessary if you had the public financing of House elections, Senate elections, and presidential elections. The principal reason that people don't want, you could do it for example, I think, believe that when the legislation that I introduced in the 1970s, which was after the Watergate, I think was 8 or 10 cents a primary voter, 12 cents in terms of a general election voter. I mean, in Massachusetts, it's somewhere around $4 or $5 million to run in a state. And that's really probably plenty. I mean, that gives you 4 or 5 weeks of television and enough to have a pretty good ground organization. Doesn't give you, you know, 15 or 24 weeks of television, but it gives you enough so that you're able to get across. Now, what happens is members of the Senate say, why in the world do I want to fund an opposition, and members of Congress, every 2 years? And they're going to get a chunk of change to run against me every 2 years. Why in the world do I want that? And why does a senator want to have a decently funded opponent every 6 years to run against me? Why do I want to have that? And somebody who was president would have a well-funded candidate that would run against him in 4 years. So they would rather not have that kind of. Most of them would rather have the existing system where they have to go on out, because they can raise a good deal more as incumbents than the challenger. The question is, what serves the country best? And the country would better be served by having well-funded challengers that would challenge members of the House and members of the Senate and the president. That would serve them best. And it would also save them the billions of dollars that would have as a result of the lobbying, and it would save the billions, I think, of dollars in terms of the kind of tax loopholes that get written in by the lobbyists into the tax bills every year that are special interests, which these lobbyists work on. Now, those are the realities. But at this present time, people say, look, I don't want my tax money used into politics. They just don't want it. But at the end of the day, they're getting it because they're paying for it with these lobbying activities, and it's something that, as I have said, too often we're getting the best Congress that money can buy, and I think it's a real disgrace.
You know, Senator, those who know the Senate well know that you've really immersed yourself in the details, the nitty-gritty of legislation, and really learned to master the procedures and personal relationships of the Senate, and have a long list of accomplishments, not just bills passed, but also conservative initiatives thwarted, I mean, including the Republican Contract for America in the mid-90s when the Democrats were in the minority in the Senate. And I was wondering if you could talk just a little bit about your education in the ways of the Senate. I mean, was there a time in your career when you felt you understood how this place works? Was there a mentor that helped you get there?
Well, I think the model was, and the standard really was is set by President Kennedy and Leverett Saltonstall. They didn't team up very often. My brother was elected to the Senate in '52. Senator Saltonstall was in there, but I noticed that they teamed up on a number of different issues. A lot of them related to particular regional issues, but I noticed that my brother and Senator Saltonstall developed a New England group of Republicans and Democrats to try and find ways of working together. I sort of grew up in that tradition about trying to get things done. I always thought that that is one of the principal reasons you're in the United States Senate, is to get things done. And that's the way I've tried to work in the United States Senate, and we have had some success. I mean, we're continuing to work now with Senator McCain on the issues of immigration and immigration reform. Right after that, we're going to work with Senator Specter on the voting rights extension, which is so important, has to be reauthorized again. We've worked with a number of different senators over the period of time. I worked with Orrin Hatch on the Ryan White legislation that dealt with AIDS, about the CHIP program that was the Children's Health Insurance Program. He was interested in children and children's issues. So we've tried to do that, and we've had some success.
I was struck by your relationships with Orrin Hatch and Alan Simpson, who were, you know, ideologically almost polar opposites of yours, maybe. But and one of the things that's interesting to me about that is that in modern Washington, it seems to me that whenever you have a conversation with someone, there's always a subtext, and you must always be thinking, well, what's really their agenda? What are they trying to manipulate me into, or how are they trying to game me? And I wonder if it's hard to develop relationships of trust in modern Washington. It seems that you have with some of these senators.
Well, we joke both with Senator Simpson and Orrin Hatch. We used to say if we sponsored each other's legislation, usually one of us hasn't read it. You know, that was. But you know, I'd find, for example, I'd be fighting with Orrin Hatch on the floor of the Senate on fetal transplantation. There was a issue with regards to basic research and NIH funding, and I'd be fighting with him in the morning, and then I'd be going down in the afternoon working with him on the Religious Restoration Act, which we eventually got passed, about state and federal impediments on terms of religious practices. For example, the state may have a rule that no children can have wine or drink wine under 16, and yet is part of the Catholic tradition in its mass, permits them to take the wine. Well, you know, there are a number of actions that similar to this in the different religions, and Orrin and I hooked up on a way to try and to protect religious rights and protect religious liberty. So, you know, even though you differ on one time, you try and find ways of working at another. And I think unless you have that kind of a temperament, if you're going to just get upset with somebody that's just going to oppose you, you're in the wrong business, because you've got to get into another business, which you have to look at this and try and figure, well, I'll try and get that person on another bill at another time.
We're listening back to the interview Senator Ted Kennedy recorded in 2006 with Fresh Air contributor Dave Davies. We'll hear more of the late senator's interview after a break. This is Fresh Air. We're remembering Senator Ted Kennedy by listening back to the interview he recorded in 2006 with Fresh Air contributor Dave Davies.
You know, Senator, growing up as a Kennedy, you were, of course, part of one of America's most prominent political families, and you write in your book about how you learn from your family values of public service. I mean, you know, your brother Joe having served and died in World War II. And I wonder, at what age did you become aware that as a Kennedy, great things might be expected of you?
Well, I was enormously lucky as a young person. I mean, I had a terrific grandparents that were forces in my life that spoke to me about bigotry and discrimination against the Irish and about the whole immigrant past. Parents, mother and father that were inspirational in terms of my spiritual upbringing. Had a very strong faith, and which has been very important to me, and also a love of history and an interest in political life and books and learning and people. And then I had brothers who really taught me about the importance of service. I mean, I had, and then I was very lucky because I saw the system work. I mean, I saw politics work. I saw the person go out and get elected to Congress. I mean, that was a big deal. I mean, the idea that you had a brother that was a congressman was just, I thought, was the biggest deal that could possibly ever happen to any family. And then
You were 14 when Jack was elected to Congress,
when
right?
he was elected. Yeah, right. And then, my God, he beats Cabot Lodge in 1952, and this is just unheard of. And Cabot Lodge was a big deal, and Republican, my brother had done, ran a good campaign. And then in the 60 campaign, to see that move and go. So I had seen, and I still believe in the political institutions functioning and working because I've seen it done. And I believe in this whole process because I've seen it work.
You know, Senator, as I hear you describe, you know, seeing your brother go to Congress when you were at 14, I mean, when I was 14, when most people are at 14, they're utterly absorbed in themselves and their friends and their, you know, their ball games or whatever is going on at school. And here you are, you know, in a climate where, as you said, people are really part of a much wider world. Did it make you a more serious kid? Did it make you think, I need to think about how I'm going to be involved in that? Did you feel pressure?
Not really. It was really the power of example. I mean, I remember my brother when he first got elected to Congress, bringing me down to Washington and taking me by myself around to the buildings, bringing me into the House floor, bringing me over to show me the Senate, and then the Supreme Court, Library of Congress. I could always remember when I'd come down from high school, I'd go down and visit him. And, you know, I'd come in for breakfast and I'd hear them talking about interesting things. No one was saying, well, you ought to do this, or ought to do that. It just seemed that the things that they were involved in, my brothers, I must say my sisters as well, Eunice with the Special Olympics, 144 different countries, my sister Jean, the very special arts programs, those that have some physical disabilities are still able to create and do incredible kinds of things. My sister Pat is very involved in a lot of the literature programs in New York City. They all were very much involved, and they were all doing interesting and involved undertakings that were involving people and events and politics. It certainly became my interest, and running for office, I was sort of thinking about that back in college. It sort of had an appeal to me, and I took it from there.
I know that besides being a father to your own children, you've had a very special, important role in the lives of the children of your brothers, President Kennedy and your brother, Senator Robert Kennedy, after their deaths. And I mean, that's been described by some as that of a surrogate father. Clearly, you've been very involved in all those kids' lives while maintaining an incredibly active and professional public life of your own. And I'm wondering, this seems to have been an enormously full, I suppose, joy and burden to carry for a long time while you were balancing this public life. And I'm just wondering if there are any insights or perspective you could share about how you have managed those competing priorities over these years.
Well, this was sort of something sort of obviously unexpected thrust on my sisters and myself, the really extraordinary, wonderful opportunity to try and make a difference in people's lives that were missing their fathers. And it's, I think, as people find out, the time and the effort and the energy that one puts in is repaid 1,000 times, and and what you get back. And they're in a wide variety of different kinds of undertakings. I mean, whether it's documentaries or environmental movements or a wide range of different Save the Children, a great many of different types of activities. But I'm enormously proud of all of them and the things that they're doing and the involvement that they're in.
Yeah. Well, thanks so much for spending some time with us, Senator Kennedy.
Fine. Listen, I appreciate it very much. It's good to talk with you. Really enjoyed it. Thanks so much.
Senator Ted Kennedy speaking with Fresh Air contributor Dave Davies in 2006. Kennedy died last night after a year-long struggle with brain cancer. Dave Davies is a senior writer for the Philadelphia Daily News. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.